Welcome to the World Economic Forum. I am Klaus Schwab. Over here, you will find the table where we eat the babies. This is where we get the adrenal chrome. Over here, we have the panel where we discuss chemtrail policy, where we could poison the world and keep us all safe from climate change. Over here, we have the discussion of how to extract all the value of Aussie people's labor via the central banking system. And over here, we have your complimentary prostitute, where I am, treat them well. I am under investigation right now.
Oh, my God.
So that's what you'd expect from the World Economic Forum. That's the history of it, is like the shadiest group of people get together and say weird shit that the rest of us have to contend with.
Yeah.
That's what it's been prior years. And if you look at our history, we've covered it pretty much every year.
Yeah. For the last 3 years.
Third year running. Let's go, buddy.
Right.
Yeah. So, but this year was different. It's a very different year. And this year, it was the Trump year. So, buckle up, stay salty, and enjoy yourselves. Let's cover the World Economic Forum.
Thank you guys so much for joining us today on another episode of Human Reaction. It is David Rand and myself in here for you today, covering all this breaking news out of Davos, Switzerland, our favorite gathering of the billionaires. What was it called? An HOA, a glorified HOA?
of rich liberals and techno-communists or something like that.
Very apt. We're glad to have you guys with us. We're going to get into all of the juiciest news out of Davos from this week. Before we do, we know that a lot of you watch this show regularly, but you may not be subscribed. So please do subscribe to the channel here on YouTube. Follow us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, wherever you're watching this. And make sure you hit the notification bell so that you get notified when we have a new episode. All right. Let's dive right into this.
Okay. So Nigel Farage gave this interview where he described the difference, and I was observing this difference beforehand. So when he came out this morning and said this, I was like, oh, okay, this puts exactly what I've experienced, as I've kind of been, you know, doing my work and then I'd check in and be like, wow, Davos is really weird this year. And then I'd come back around and just seeing the difference myself. So he articulates as well. It's a good plan here.
Done well. Everyone's glad to see you. A bit surprised to see you. You used to really slag off all the globalists at the WEF.
Oh, I slagged off the European Parliament for 20 years, but I still went there once a month. And I think I genuinely upset them virtually every time I turned up. Isn't it interesting? I mean, you know, 5 years ago, here at Davos, the main topic of conversation was climate change, DEI, all that baloney. And here we are, 5 years on, and the debate's completely different. It's being dominated by AI, tech, energy. And the one thing I've enjoyed over the last couple of days, there is genuine debate. That there are different opinions now, rather than the sort of consensus view that I certainly felt was coming out from the globalists. So I found it really interesting and worthwhile.
Well,
can I just note that the UK, when they say slag off, just sounds way different in the American.
I was just thinking that. What is the American context of the term slag off?
Oh, man. Just avoid it, I guess. Like, dislike it. Diss it from a diss, and you're disrespecting it.
Yeah. It sounds a little bit feistier, maybe, than that. But we'll give it that in the interest of being diplomatic.
It sounds really gay.
That's true as well. That is true.
Yeah. So, yeah, that's it. That's an interesting component of the dynamic is what he said there.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that's certainly what we're seeing. And just to frame it up front, my view is maybe a little bit skeptical of this massive shift. I don't necessarily know if their underlying views have changed or if they are recognizing through the publicity that this event has gotten over the last handful of years, with all of us watching from the outside in and basically mocking it the entire time. If they're realizing they have a tremendous branding and messaging crisis and they need to do something to win back the public trust, if you will, which I think is that ship has sailed personally. I mean, they're not winning back my trust, I don't think, anytime soon without like tremendous action in a very, very different direction. But it seems like, I don't know, they might be speaking out of one side of their mouth and then doing something else behind the scenes. And there's certainly enough evidence of that from some of the reporting that's gone on, James O'Keefe's reporting particularly, on some of the things there. So
yeah, that events around Davos now kind of contain this rather than the actual main stage.
Right.
And we do have some tease of that we're going to be talking about at the very end. So hold on to the very end if you want to see how they're still looking at making you eat the bugs and live in the pod. That's still going on at Davos. Mm-hmm. We have a clip we're going to play at the end and talk about. But that said, a lot of this time around was dominated by the big orange, man. Like Donald Trump just living rent-free in all these elites' heads. And, you know, as many criticisms as I've had of him and praises I've had of him, it's just so delicious to watch these people sweat.
For sure.
You know what I mean?
For sure.
Just because, like, they're so secure. You know what I mean? They don't feel the way I feel about the conditions of the world because they're wealthy European elites for the most part.
They're completely insulated from the realities of life.
Yes. Yeah, right, right. So, I mean, and to the degree that anyone is, and trying to look at them as human. And the other part of that is just that, well, I like
I'm kidding.
The other part of that is just that this is a social club at the end of the day, that they are as much as your text group or your friend group kind of goes with what's happening in the world and kind of evolves over time to talk about different stuff. That they will too, right?
Sure.
That it's not like it's not some big centralized plan. It's actually just the culture of these people and what they care about. So it just kind of bubbles up. And now that other issues are more important, they've become more of the main stage.
That's true.
Could be a bit of both.
The only difference there is that my bros chat does not attempt to run the world, at least not in the same way that these people actually have the ability to.
Would it if it could?
Perhaps,
yeah.
But we are short several hundred billion dollars keeping 100%. Us from doing that. So
yeah.
Big difference there, you know, and also this is sort of like you mentioned, there are these two circles. There's the private conversations that are going on in the after parties and the side rooms and all that stuff. And then there's what's broadcast to the public. And perhaps some of that is a little bit of performance theater for them, you know, trying to tell us what they think we want to hear. And some of it's probably true. I think there is a very rational reason to pivot from ESG and DEI and climate change to understanding, shit, actually, we have this new technology, AI, and everything that surrounds it, robotics, and all the stuff that requires a tremendous amount of energy. And the simple math to anyone that, you know, cares to look into it is that wind and solar aren't going to run that for you. They're not going to work. And we've got clips of, you know, European chancellors, Merz, for example, talking about how Europe and Germany both have sort of missed the boat on growth because they've been so insistent upon green initiatives that they've completely let their growth stagnate. So
it's really amazing to watch this guy say that because he's not exactly AFD either, right?
No.
He's like from the moderate, you know, right side. So this is a radicalization from Europe in a more pro-market realism-based energy policy, perhaps.
Yes.
Let's check it out.
Let's do it.
We are aware of those problems. Both Germany and Europe have wasted incredible potential for growth in recent years by dragging feet on reforms and unnecessarily and excessively curtailing entrepreneurial freedoms and personal responsibility. We are going to change that now. Security and predictability take precedence over excessive regulation and misplaced perfection. We must reduce bureaucracy substantially in Europe. The single market was once created to form the most competitive economic area in the world. But instead, we have become the world champion of overregulation. That has to end.
Accurate.
We are
totally
aware.
Accurate. Totally accurate. And I love that he's saying that we've basically bloated bureaucracy to a bunch of people who like are bureaucrats who have been doing this for the last decade.
Or at least empowered them, right? Yeah. These are business leaders. These are the politicians who spent the last 30 years building the neoliberal international apparatus, right?
So the expert class.
To the degree that, you know, they're in there talking about that, but that also represents where a lot of things are going, right? For a lot of, it's funny, you know, points of crisis start happening and all of a sudden, a lot of very libertarian-ish, conservatarian kind of ideas all of a sudden get really into vogue.
Yeah.
When there's a real crisis, right? And that's where we're coming to. I mean, even look at like Ezra Klein. He's a New York Times reporter and, you know, runs their podcast and all that kind of stuff. He recently released a book last year called Abundance, which pretty much argues to other liberals, and he's like a liberal, that we need to reform the way we do environmental permitting.
Yeah.
Which you would, 5 years ago, would never have guessed that was going to happen, but with you know, the existing challenges as they are, all of a sudden people are saying, wow, maybe we need to approach things differently. That should be celebrated to the Absolutely. Degree that we believe it's authentic.
Right.
The question is, do you believe it's authentic?
Well, I think there is authenticity there because, as we alluded to in the episode that we did recently on the major breakout in silver and gold, there is this sort of strategic realignment, and there is this rush for resources and minerals, and we're shifting from this highly globalized just-in-time economy globally to a much more bifurcated, sort of insular, nationally protectionist kind of world, you know? And so there is a need to have energy security for yourself and to not be reliant on other nations for energy or for the raw inputs to your technology sector. If you want to be industrially resilient, you have to have control over those supply chains. And so I think there is a need now, given the way the world has changed in the last 3 to 4 years, especially since COVID, where we saw firsthand how these just-in-time supply chains broke down as soon as there was one relatively major, but one hiccup in the system. Right. So I think that is certainly seems to be where a lot of the leadership is going in terms of like themes here.
Additionally, ironic to that is that those are all phenomenons created by governments and then suffered by governments to then create the new phenomena. Right. Yeah. So COVID was what it was, not because COVID was that deadly. It was deadly for a certain demographic of people, but because of governments' reactions to COVID creates the conditions in which now everyone is thinking much more insularly, even more so than before. Mm-hmm. Donald Trump was just ahead of the curve there. Mm-hmm. And now Donald Trump's kind of breaking apart these international institutions and kind of not really abiding by them or caring about them is creating an additional response of more insularness and more kind of protectionist thinking and more imperial-like thinking. I don't mean imperial, mercantilist-like thinking, where I'm thinking, how can I get the resources and make sure I'm doing well, rather than trusting in the systems to provide for those things decentrally.
Right.
Right. And which is typically works quite well as long as you're not in a situation of war.
Right.
Right. Where, and all of a sudden we're at war with the world, it seems like, with the big orange end.
Well, exactly. And that's interesting too, because it's not necessarily kinetic war, but it's economic war, right? That we're realizing there aren't enough chairs for everyone to sit in. The music just stopped. And now everyone's kind of scrambling to get their chairs. And I think that's played a lot into Trump's moves for Greenland, you know, what happened in Venezuela, and the way that he's interacting with Europe now as a result of those things. And, you know, the whole scare we had earlier this week about, actually, I'm going to put these huge tariffs on Europe. Actually, no, I'm not. You know, it's kind of the schizophrenic move, but it's all this real-time negotiation that's happening. It's putting a lot of tension on the stability of the trade relationship between the U.S. and Europe.
100%. And that's what the first few days really were, was reacting to that environment of the tariffs of Greenland and all these things. And just look at this guy. This is a Belgian Prime Minister, Bart De Wever. And as he's talking about kind of the new way that the world is. And I got a couple of clips from him, and I just think the overall picture of it is interesting.
But now so many red lines are being crossed that you have the choice between your self-respect. Being a happy vessel is one thing. Being a miserable slave is something else. If you back down now, you're going to lose your dignity. And that's probably the most precious thing you can have in a democracy. It's your dignity. But now...
That's strong words, right?
Yeah.
I mean, like, that's how they're relating and articulating to each other about this pressure from America. And then this is his opinion of America, how Trump is acting.
Mm-hmm. Do you share that view that we can take it for granted that the U.S. is an ally of Europe?
Unfortunately not. I would like to confirm that they are an ally, but then they have to behave like an ally.
Mm-hmm. Do you still...
That's a two-way street, though, is it not?
Yeah.
And has the European Union really behaved like an ally of the United States?
That's a good question. And that's what Trump's point has been for quite some time, is like, hey, you're not pulling your weight at NATO. You're not really doing the thing. You're actually just living off of us.
Mm-hmm.
Now, America does benefit from the European market. We sell a bunch of stuff there. We import a bunch of stuff there. So are we enemies? No. There's a whole lot of places to be that's not ally and that's not an enemy.
Right. True. Right? True, but it's certainly starting to trend in that direction, especially with a lot of the censorship moves that are happening, that are putting the brakes on X, for example, you know, operating in the European Union. If they don't put on these oppressive censorship protocols, then, you know, they're going to boot them out or whatever. I mean, like, there's certain things that are happening that are much more adversarial from both ends. It's not just the United States or Trump being overtly, you know, aggressive towards Europe, I think.
For sure. And they've always been other countries, right? Not all just vassals, like Belgium is articulating himself as, which is itself a very interesting moment. You could not imagine 5 years ago of there being an international forum where a country like Belgium or any of these places said, yeah, I mean, we felt like a vassal, but now we feel like a slave. That would be a wild moment. That would be, but now it's just like, oh, wow, look at that. And just go flies right by. We don't even hardly notice.
Yeah.
So here's another one. And this is the most interesting one because he makes the case that his suspicion is that this is structural, not just Trump.
We've been accustomed to very nice presidents like Obama, and we haven't noticed that the shift in America is not bound to one presidency. It's a structural shift. The face of America has turned to the Pacific. Their backside is turned to the Atlantic. And that will not change after Trump. It's a structural thing.
Let's say something.
Well, what does he mean by that? The United States has turned to face the Pacific and their back is to the Atlantic.
Well, it's what Obama called the Asian pivot. Right, and has been talked about in foreign policy circles for a long time, that there is a need to confront the rising China power and their control across the South China Sea and into Indonesia and other interests there that are much more in America's direct interest than the Middle East or Eastern Europe.
Sure.
Yeah, which was more typical of the prior eras, right? So think of like bombing Yugoslavia during the Clinton campaign, right? Mm-hmm. All of Bush 1 being involved in the Middle East. And a lot of those are to make sure that Saudi oil continues to go, not to America, but to Europe.
Right.
Yeah.
So really what they're experiencing is a turning of America's interest in expressing power to other interests that aren't so much in Europe's direct benefit. Mm-hmm. So they're all of a sudden, you know, it's as if they're being confronted by bullies and their big strong friend turned to go fight another battle, and now they're feeling a little left out in the cold.
Something like that, yeah. And then additionally that, the bully is saying, hey, I want to be paid for this now. And what I want is this big chunk of ice called Greenland. And they're like, no, we can't do that. That would be imperialism. It's an imperial holding, guys.
It's a colony.
We're just all fighting over a colony here. Like, no one's the good guy. Denmark's not the good guy. This is a different ethnic group being ruled over by a bunch of whites.
Well, and apparently not very kindly either, as far as I understand.
They have their own complicated history with it. Now, I'm just saying, like, this is all, and I don't even understand why we want Greenlands to this day. I still don't. I got to have a whole thing we'll dig into when we get there. But, the whole thing is, like, the way they react is as unbelievable as the so-called reasons why we want Greenland, right? Like, you're up being like on their fainting couches. Oh my God, can you believe he wants Greenland? It's like, it's
like not even attached to your continent, guys.
Yeah, right. It's not even... yeah. Okay. And then this other one. I think this was really enlightening when it came to, you know, a politician contending with their rhetoric around these things, because this kind of shows just kind of how over the skis I think these European pundits were.
Who is this we're about to hear from here?
This is the Finnish president of Finland.
Oh, gotcha. Okay.
First is a direct answer to the question of this panel. Can Europe defend itself? My answer is unequivocally yes.
Without the Americans?
Without the Americans. I mean...
How?
Well, look...
But you're relying on them for these key elements. You've said earlier that Europe can defend itself without the Americans. If it comes down...
Not exact. My exit, that's not a quote.
I'm pretty sure he said unequivocally. I'm pretty sure he just said unequivocally.
He is dealing in a different language in his own, so maybe there's some of that, you know.
Maybe he meant equivocally.
But, you know, just there's this, and this is an interesting contrast, right? Because they've for a very long time benefited from America kind of buying their complicity. Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, they've undermined America in the meantime in various different ways that a sovereign countries want to do, because they are a sovereign country, not simply a vassal state. So are we... And to the degree that, you know, they've paid into NATO some, yes, but not to their treaty obligations. Totally true. So what should we expect from Europe at that point, right? Well, would we expect to have an unfair trade agreement with them? Well, you wouldn't think so, especially because we spend all this money on their defense. It's 50 is, I can't remember the number. It's around 50,000. It might be more troops in Germany
right.
to this day.
Yeah.
Why? Why are they there?
Yeah.
To protect Germany. From who?
Yeah. Good question.
Yeah.
does Germany not have the troops to do that themselves?
Well, we might not allow them to build one. You know, I mean, I don't know.
That's true. I mean, I guess they do have a little bit of a history there with standing armies.
So I don't know. I mean, it's a weird place to be in if you're European, because then you're like, you know, I also see it like this. Ayn Rand had this great theory that like, if you are the beneficiary of largesse or generosity, at first it can really impact you as just thankfulness, just appreciation. But after a while, it begins to become more of like a right, more of like a something that you deserve.
An expectation, yeah.
And then it becomes resentment for the person providing it for you, because there's an innate subservience to the person who is providing that for you.
Yeah, sure.
And you have to really guard your heart against that. And the degree to which that is invaded European culture is, I think, what we're really noticing with some of the stuff where they've really taken it for granted for so long. These people's political careers for 50 years has been on the assumption that America will always be there to bail them out and defend them forever. And maybe that's not true anymore. You know, and that's why, like, you see like this Belgian prime minister, this Finnish prime minister, the German chancellor, all these guys contending with that.
Mm-hmm.
And that is because Big Daddy himself is in town. And let's dive into Trump's WEF speech. Let me bring this up.
Yesterday marked the 1 year anniversary of my inauguration. And today, after 12 months back in the White House, our economy is booming. Growth is exploding. Productivity is surging, investment is soaring, incomes are rising, inflation has been defeated, our previously open and dangerous border is closed and virtually impenetrable, and the United States is in the midst of the fastest and most dramatic economic turnaround in our country's history. Under the Biden administration, America was plagued by the nightmare of stagflation, meaning low growth and high inflation, a recipe for misery, failure, and decline. But now, after just 1 year of my policies, we are witnessing the exact opposite, virtually no inflation and extraordinarily high economic growth, growth like, I believe you'll see very shortly, our country has never seen before, perhaps no country has ever seen before. Over the past 3 months, core inflation has been just 1.6%. Meanwhile, fourth quarter growth is projected to be 5.4%, far greater than anybody other than myself and a few others had predicted.
Yeah. Does it feel like that to you? How's that feel? Does it feel like prices have leveled off? I mean, 1% growth is nominal. Like, that's...
I think it probably depends on where you're looking and what you feel the most in your life.
Mm-hmm.
You know, certainly gas prices are pretty reasonable right now. I think that's one place where the Trump administration has gotten a win. Mm-hmm. However, they've been able to do that, seizing tankers and I don't know, bombing Venezuela. I'm not sure what the other factors
prices,
are. In
no, the, those aren't why gas prices are low.
I know,
gas
I
prices
know.
Are low is because for the most part, you know, the Biden administration stopped exploration. It didn't really level off any amount of permitting.
Sure.
And then permits really opened up during the Trump.
Right.
Beginning of Trump era. So
just teasing on the seizing oil tankers thing. But I think it depends on where you're looking. I mean, I think that the housing market is in a bit of a correction, or it's entering one. So you could look at that and say prices are coming down, for better or for worse, depending on who you are. You know, if you've got a lot of home equity, maybe you're not looking at that so fondly. But I don't know. I mean, like, what's CPI show, and what are the you know, the more comprehensive baskets of inflation show in terms of rate of inflation right now?
Yeah, I mean, it's there's a lot of questions about whether or not those are reliable. In terms of even CPI is just a flawed thing. It's like,
right,
they do the best to try to do their darndest economic calculus as you can, but the reality is that the price mechanism can't be captured by a measurement.
Right.
That's a reality. And right, how we feel about the economy is much more complicated, right?
Because
it doesn't matter to me so much about how much have gone up in the last year. What matters to me is since 2020.
Right.
That said, he can only control what's going on now. Mm-hmm. And if he's claiming that it's 1%, and indeed is a 1%, that's got to be some kind of rough measurement of improvement, sure. especially compared to where we're at 2 years ago.
Yeah.
And then, you know, where's the where's that economic calculus coming from, or that economic growth coming from? That 4%. I did find Atlantic Fed confirming potentially 5% growth for quarter four, which it would be very big.
Yeah.
That said, what is driving that?
Right. Is it government spending that's driving that? That's a big question.
Obviously, that's some of it. Keep in mind, GDP is literally all spending. Right. And it's just not that helpful of a measurement of prosperity. It's a helpful measurement of output, like things happening, but that doesn't actually tell you about welfare or about how good people are doing. And what I always harp on, if I might get on that soapbox real quick, is that the economy is an engine for solving needs. Right. And if we get growth, but needs can't be solved because they're priced out or because there are logistical reasons or whatever reason, then your economy isn't doing its function. Right. It's not actually performing what we're trying to do with it.
Right.
So the number doesn't embody that. It embodies something else.
Right.
I'm not sure, like, if you look at the core health, and this, it wouldn't be solvable in a year. Most of these questions, right? The big questions, which is, are like, what is our actual savings rate per household? You know, it's ridiculously low. It has been for decades. And mm-hmm. all these cheap money prices and our policies for a very long time have made all these things terrible. What actually ended stagflation throughout the Biden era? It's probably the high interest rates. That's what ended stagflation in the late 70s. So the degree to which interest rates are high and people are complaining about it is like, well, you could either have that or you can have inflation. Right. Are you happy about the inflation? Numbers being a little lower? Well, that's probably because of the high interest rates.
Right.
So, you know, challenging questions at hand, right? I'd be like, I don't know, but I hope he's right. You know, at the end of the day, I kind of listened to that. I was like, you know what? It doesn't feel that bad at the moment, I guess.
It doesn't feel like an emergency where you go to the grocery store week over week and the chicken that you bought last week is now 25-30% more expensive.
That's right. There's no stories like, oh, we killed 3 million chickens this week. You know, none of those have happened lately or whatever.
Right.
So there's some of that.
We know, though, that Trump measures the economy, at least in a very rough sense, by the stock market, right? Like he looks at that. He looks at number go up. He looks at green and says, we're doing well, mm-hmm. which isn't exactly accurate because we know that asset prices inflate when the dollar is devalued, right? When we're printing money and monetizing debt, which we've been doing for a very, very long time. What have we lost? 50% of the purchasing power of the dollar since COVID? Mm-hmm. Is that about right?
It's an enormous amount. I think
it's a lot.
Right.
And you're seeing it in, I mean, like back to the gold and silver episode we did last week. You're seeing it in precious metals. You're seeing it in the stock market. And Trump's whole thing is, you know, the stock market's going to double. Mark my words, it's going to double. Well, mm-hmm. is that really an accurate measure of economic health?
Well, it'd be nice for my 401k, but that's about it. And I'm not retiring anytime soon. And
if you're not someone who's heavily invested in the stock market or precious metals or other hard assets, real estate or whatever it might be, then you're not benefiting from
it. I'd rather the things I buy just be affordable, actually.
Right.
Have a higher 401k at the moment. But that's being selfish.
Yeah.
Well, okay. So this might give you some context to those numbers that might fill in a little bit about the why. Now, I couldn't confirm any of these, and I tried, but we'll see how this, let's see how it goes. Let's see how it goes.
Nations to pay for the damage that they've caused. In 12 months, we have removed over 270,000 bureaucrats from the federal payrolls, the largest single year reduction in government employment since the end of World War II. Nobody thought that was coming, but we had no choice. To make a country great, you can't have all federal jobs. We've cut federal spending by $100 billion and slashed the federal budget deficit by 27% in the single year. It's going to go down quite a bit more from that, driving inflation way down from the record highs of the Biden administration. Every month, they went up and up and up. I promised to cut 10 old regulations for every single new regulation, but instead I've cut, actually till this point, 129 regulations for every one new regulation approved. So every time they come in with a new regulation, we do at least 10, but so far it's averaging out to 129, if you can believe it.
Okay.
So that's the first I've heard that on the regulation bit. That's actually really encouraging.
I mean, great. Where are we seeing that? Yeah, well, where are we feeling that?
Well, I mean, okay, so what I really looked for And I can't confirm any of those, right? Like, all those are internal government numbers that have no third-party external resource that I was able to find. And I did look. This year, there should be an Office of Management and Budget report called the Federal Regulation Agenda, which should tell us what happened last year. Okay. So that waiting for that report will be able to confirm how substantial this is.
Yeah.
What it actually looks like for how we can understand this impact of the company. Now, most economic... Okay, so libertarians get really, and conservatives get really hung up on, like, if you cut regulations, things would become cheaper, more affordable. That's true, but it's true over a longer scale of time than is usually measurable in politics or economics.
And that's because it takes time for companies to reorient towards a more deregulated environment?
Okay, so how do you interact with regulations? How does it actually happen in your life? It doesn't happen where you're like looking at the federal code and like trying to figure out what can I do? You know, like that's not how it works.
Right.
How it happens is you say, that's a cool idea. Can I, you know, and then let's go try to create economic activity with that idea. And then you go out and you hire a lawyer somewhere in the process and say, can I do this idea? And they say, no, you can't. Here's the federal regulation.
Right.
You're the only step in that that actually will has changed is where the lawyer comes in at the very end.
Mm-hmm.
And then that lawyer doesn't say, actually, you can do that. They repealed this regulation last year, 6 months ago, 10 years ago, 5 years, 5 seconds ago.
Right.
Unless it's a big one. And that takes policy. That takes legislative code change. And those ones happen more immediately. These regulations we're talking about, for the most part, or where there's already discretionary authority for regulations. And these are where the most amount of regulations happen, but they're usually the most on the edge, right? You can smelt, but you can't, but you can smelt this way, but not this way. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
Yep.
Or other, you know, you can make steel, but you make steel this way, but not this way. And these are changing those or repealing some of those that are outdated or whatever.
Yeah.
Right. So, gotcha. And keep in mind too, the federal code is enormous. It's freaking huge, right? So we're talking millions of regulations. So even these numbers are still a drop in the bucket, a great thing, but still a drop in the bucket. So until we get that raw number, not just one for every 129, you know, because for all we know, they advance one regulation, they cut 129, right. Or two regulations, they cut out 240, whatever,
yeah,
you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So therefore, you know, until we actually know the raw amount that they actually cut, which is unfortunate they don't have that. That would be really... That's what Milei has, right? When he's going around talking, he's talking, he gives a number,
yeah,
right?
A hard number.
Why don't we have that number? Why aren't they saying that number every single day, right? That would give so much more something for people who want to support the Trump administration to sink their teeth into good about.
We need that on the U.S. debt clock page.
Yes.
How many regulations have been cut?
Yes. I want a White House page that does that.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Like they did with COVID with the death counter on every news report ever. We just need every news station, every, you know, the White House website to just have a rolling counter of how many regulations have been repealed.
Bureaucrats fired, regulations cut, yeah. Immigration stopped, yeah. Deported, you know, like just put up your wins.
Give us
bro.
A scoreboard. Yeah. Let's see it.
It would be much better. That said, I mean, like look at the Doge effort to do that very thing and then it all fell apart.
Yeah.
You know, and that's part of the tragedy here. The other part of what he said there is cutting spending, which I was like looking for. I was like, how?
Yeah.
What?
He quoted 27% cut in the federal budget deficit. Was that what it was?
Yeah.
Where is that? Someone tell me where to find that.
So he would be talking about the U.S. federal deficit, right? Which is, this is our annual deficit, $1.7 trillion. So is he saying we would have been over $200 trillion if it wasn't for some action that he did? Is that what he's saying?
I don't know.
I just can't. I mean, look how fast it's going. It's funny, Joe, because as I get older, it used to be I would go to US. I've been going to usdebtclock.org since 2010, 2009, yeah. Somewhere in there when I first came across politics. And goddamn, like I'm looking at it now and I don't even recognize it.
You know what's funny?
$7 trillion in spending. How did we get to $7 trillion in spending? You know, like what happened there? And you're gonna tell me that we cut spending somewhere along the way? It's something that matters. Like, come on.
Exactly. And then that is where I really think that, like, I mean, obviously this whole speech is a lot of bluster. But do you remember when we did the debt clock?
Yeah,
it was like $14 trillion then.
Yes,
14.
Yeah. What Joe's talking about is when we were in college together. Yeah, we go way back.
We go way back.
You didn't know. We did an event on campus with Young Americans for Liberty where we took these plywood boards, like big ones, like 4 foot tall or something like
that.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Maybe a foot or two wide. Mm-hmm. And we painted big numbers on it. And then we stacked them up to adding up to 14 trillion across campus and just how many zeros that was. Mm-hmm. And it was this awesome event. We got to talk to all the people about the debt and inflation and how it hurts them, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, 14 then. Now 14 it's 38 trillion dollars here. And look at federal tax revenue is at 5 trillion and our spending is at 7. You got to be shitting me that we are doing something about spending here. I just don't see it.
Yeah.
What's worse is they just requested an even bigger defense budget. Like right now the defense budget is 900 billion and they want to up it to 1.5 trillion.
Mm-hmm.
And then how are we going to get the taxes for that?
And meanwhile, the interest on the debt is very close to $1 trillion a year.
Yes, the interest on the debt itself is going up. So I don't, he's trying to sell too hard, man. I'm like, I would more appreciate it. He's like, we're doing regulations, we're doing energy, we're doing all this, the legitimate wins. And he does mm-hmm. do a good job with those legitimate wins. And eliminating the bureaucrats, I freaking love it, bro. Keep going. Yeah. You know, I'm like, yeah. And then say, but my Congress sucks. Yeah, you know? Right. And I can't get a defensive budget out of these people. Now, it's actually his job to propose the budget that they then they approve or not.
Mm-hmm.
But, and you're definitely not helping with the $1.5 trillion thing.
No.
So.
Moving on.
Yeah.
Because we could harp on this forever.
Yeah. Yeah.
We have been since 2009.
All right. Let's see here. I want to skip to Greenland. We're doing things a little bit of fly by the seat of our pants today, guys. We don't have our actual anchor, Kyle, here to make this all run smoothly. Ultimately. So you got to tolerate me running the laptop here. But we kind of jumping around, get to Greenland. These comments are interesting. This isn't his whole comment because he like says it, then he goes off into a bunch of other, and then comes back around and gets to the final reason.
The weave.
But I do think this is an important part to look at his mental model here with Greenland. Oh yeah, and I wanted to mention that this is before he came. He's now said that he has some deal with NATO's Secretary General
over Greenland.
Over right. Greenland. I have no idea what it means. We could talk about it.
Yeah.
Right. These are matters of national security, and perhaps no current issue makes the situation more clear than what's currently going on with Greenland. Would you like me to say a few words of Greenland? I was going to leave it out of this.
You know, this is what you got to appreciate about this guy. He's like in this room full of all these billionaires and leaders of state, and he's just like, you want me to talk about Greenland? Huh? You know, I know what you want to do. I see you over there.
Let's see a show of hands, bitches. Let's see those hands. It's
just the chutzpah. I love it.
You know what? You can't say the guy isn't entertaining. Mm-hmm. You know, whatever beef you might have with him, boy, he is really entertaining. All right.
Speech, but I think I would have been reviewed very negatively. I have tremendous respect for both the people of Greenland and the people of Denmark. Tremendous respect. But every NATO ally has an obligation to be able to defend their own territory. And the fact is, no nation or group of nations is in any position to be able to secure Greenland other than the United States. We're a great power, much greater than people even understand. I think they found that out 2 weeks ago in Venezuela. We saw this in World War II when Denmark fell to Germany after just 6 hours of fighting.
Ooh. A little bit of shade, a little bit of shade.
So
great respect, but so y'all are wimps.
That's where he goes. He like goes off. He doesn't ever get over that sort of thing. And then he comes back around, and just to shorthand it, comes back around and be like, look, we've been supporting you forever, all throughout the Cold War. All I want is just one little piece of ice. One little, just give me that one little thing, right? And I'll leave you guys all alone. And that's where we get the whole, like, the slave, not a vassal, all this kind of resentment is because of that, right? Because yeah. It's like, no, you don't get it. That, at least that this is from the European perspective. We have our identity in that we're not your vassals, right? But now you're making us confront it every single day.
Mm.
You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And that breeds resentment. And so then they're digging their heels in. And then he comes out and he says that the NATO Secretary General and him have a framework of a future deal. They ask Rutte, who is the Secretary General, Mark Rutte, He denied that discussions covered Greenland's sovereignty or transfer of control, but he said the issue did not come up in their discussions, but rather to talk about Arctic security. Okay. So in this speech, he basically lays out that it's somehow dangerous for other countries to be able to get access to these northern routes. All right. So this is a view from the North Pole. You got the United States of America with Alaska up here, Canada, you have the Russian Federation and Norway, right?
Mm-hmm.
NATO land, Russia.
Right.
China is way down here. It has nothing to do with anything. I don't know what he's talking about.
Well, right? No, I mean, what he may be talking about is that China can use these passages to make its trade more efficient, right?
Yeah. So China can already use the northeastern corridor, which is this like striped one right here, right?
Sure.
China can go through here and they can deliver goods to Europe with that route, sure, much more efficiently than going over the Horn of Africa.
Right.
Right. Going through the Mediterranean is another way that they get there, and there are ways to do that, right? But what we control is this whole thing right here, right? Now, what they're talking about is a future theoretical route that someday might exist, and this is why we need it, which is the Transpolar Sea Route. The Transpolar Sea Route goes right across the middle here. You know what the problem with that is, Joe, right now?
Well, is it covered with ice, David?
It's covered with ice! There's nothing there! The only like giant like Look, things that can break through that ice can go through there. Even in the height of summer, so in the wintertime, these all freeze up,
yep,
right? And you need special boats to get through. This is all freezes up in the wintertime,
yep,
right? So only in the summertime are these routes even available as it is. So they're talking about we need to own Greenland for some reason to protect something that goes through the middle here, when it's like, who does that benefit? We can already ship this way and this way. So who are we benefiting?
I don't think that it's all about trade. It's not all about trade, right?
Yeah.
It is also about, as I understand it, it's about the Golden Dome, right? You remember the Golden Dome thing about the missile defense?
Yeah.
Right? Greenland stands right in between the United States, Washington, D.C. specifically, and the flight path, the most efficient flight path of Russia's potential nuclear missiles, right?
Yes.
So the whole idea, I think, there is we want military installations there to be able to defend from a potential nuke.
Yes. So the reason why that's ridiculous is because almost all of our... we have 900 bases in 180 countries.
Yeah.
If we want to put the Golden Dome in Greenland, we say, Denmark, hey, would you like to be protected from nuclear waste fallout forever?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, sir. And then they would put it in. Like, it's ridiculous. There's a nothing burger on that one, too. It doesn't make any sense.
And I think the other piece is the ongoing resource war. I think that's a huge piece that's not being talked about
as much. In this speech, he says, basically, there isn't that much there compared to other places. It's mostly about refining, and there's no refining anywhere close to Greenland. So, like, it would take an enormous... Like Trump says this in the speech that he just says, well, he's justifying Greenland.
So then is it about the giant alien ship that's buried under the ice then?
That might be it.
Okay.
That might be
okay.
it.
Okay, because I'm like, there's got to be something to this. He's not just ruffling Europe's feathers over nothing. So why?
It can't possibly be exactly what it looks like. That's the trick. Is it just, he really just wants to say he got another territory for the
He wants his Louisiana country. Purchase moment, his Alaska moment.
Yeah.
You think that's it? It's just legacy and ego?
I mean, because his case is like, we can't just lease it, because we lease it, then we don't really own it. We don't have a right to defend. It's like, that's not at all how any of this has ever worked in America's history. We've treated bases in Iraq as strong as we do bases in Louisiana. Are you shitting me?
Well, we have a base in Germany. We don't own Germany. Do we have a right to defend Germany? I'm sure they would say, yeah, you fucking got it.
Yeah, right. Well, and we have treaty obligations. We have the same treaty obligation in NATO to defend Germany as we do Greenland, right? Because Greenland is also covered by NATO. So like none of this, I don't know. To the degree to which the Constitution compels us to actually follow our treaty obligations, if you're a strict constructionist, you would believe that that's true. Therefore, NATO should be taken really seriously if you're a constitutionalist. And if you're a constitutionalist, that means that I fail to see why you wouldn't have a casus belli for defending Greenland, a just cause of war for defending Greenland at that point, were they to be invaded by Russia. Why would Russia invade Greenland?
For the alien ship that's buried under the ice, dude.
Okay. All right, what alien ship? You seem way more committed to this bit than I thought you were.
We do not need to go down this rabbit hole. We can talk about it in the conspiracy theory channel in the Discord. But, all right. I came across an X post and went down a moderately sized rabbit hole about this weather modification alien ship that's buried under the ice. It's like 50 miles long by 3 miles wide. It contains the giant aliens that were depicted in the Easter Island statues that are like 60 to 80 feet tall. And it's an ancient aliens thesis, I think.
Greenland's a little ways away from Easter Island.
Well, but they're all on a clear axis.
Oh, right? Really?
You can trace a line straight through that and a bunch of other lines.
Okay.
Yeah. You know, like they aligned the pyramids of Giza to the stars, right? Like that's a thing.
Cool.
It seems crazy. I'm not saying I buy it.
I love it. Let's get weird, dude.
I'm just saying.
If you want to get weird with this, join the Discord. You can find the link below. We're going to get crazy in that conspiracy channel. Let's go.
Hell yeah.
Okay. So really, I still don't understand the Greenland thing. It might just be what it looks like. There might be aliens. I don't know. But what we do have is some other interesting things coming down from Davos that I do think was interesting, especially when you look at it just from the point of view of like the monetary theory, especially. We have some stuff, developments on crypto. I really wish Kyle was here to talk about it. And money. So this is Ray Dalio talking about the monetary order is breaking down. Dun dun.
Let's step back from the sensational and be clear about what I mean. The monetary order is breaking down. Okay. What I mean by the monetary order is that fiat currencies and debt as a storehold of wealth is not being held by central banks in the same way. And that there was a change. The biggest market to move last year was the gold market, far better than the tech markets, right, and so on. And the U.S. markets underperformed foreign markets because of the fact you could see it in the numbers of the central banks and so on. So let's just look at the fact that on the other side of trade deficits and trade wars, there are capital and capital wars. And so as we're looking at that, and you reported what the stock market and so on, but you didn't report that the gold market is also up 3%.
We did say that earlier this morning. Okay. It's up to record levels again.
Look at what is happening and why it's happening, mm-hmm, and who's buying it. So let's just take a moment on that capital war issue, okay?
So just stopping there, we can continue playing if we want to get into it. But
sure.
I do find that claim that sovereign debts are being less held, they're not buying treasury bonds as much as they otherwise might. And this is an early indicator of that. And that puts the question of Venezuela in an interesting context, especially if you look at his five forces, Dalio's five, geopolitics being the third one there, that forcing them to trade in dollars creates dollar demand, et cetera, et cetera. Right. That's always been the argument around the petrodollar as the underlying, you know,
requirement to hold dollars in order to be able to trade.
And a theory of foreign policy, right?
Sure.
That we
enforcing that.
We have the deal that we do with Saudi Arabia, and that we sacrifice tremendous amounts of goodwill across the Middle East because of that deal, in part because they deal in dollars, therefore demanding dollars for one of the most valuable resources in the world, oil.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So if that system's breaking down, what does that mean?
Woo,
that's a big one.
Well, it is. We're seeing central banks. We have been seeing central banks, Russia, China, European nations, all starting to hold more gold and stockpile more gold and also silver, but more for industrial purposes. That's less the central bank asset thing. Mm. But I think that's kind of the rotation that we're starting to see. There seems to be some fear, I think, that this would indicate some fear among central bankers around the world that the debt system is looking shaky at best, and maybe something more serious is coming that they're not letting us know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think this buys in and really gives context to our discussions around what the trade-offs here are in a post monetary kind of debt, U.S. Treasury debt as like the baseline of everything. The post-Bretton Woods in today's world where the U.S. kind of dominates everything. What does that mean, especially when you look at the geopolitics?
Right.
Because then you're saying, okay, is everyone moving to a mercantilist mindset? Because if we're not all in the dollar, There's all kinds of reasons why that would be more true. Right? It's another force kind of pushing, fractionalizing, and like Brexiting and all these sorts of things into different, more, you know, spheres of influence type of world.
Mm-hmm.
100%.
Yeah.
Let's see what else we got.
We know that both the holders of U.S. dollar denominated debt, which is money, and those who need it, the United States, are worried about each other, right? Mm-hmm. So if you have other countries who are holding it and they're worried about each other and we're producing a lot of it, that's a big issue, right? So you have to explain what is going on with fiat currencies, mm-hmm. generally speaking. And now if you take the conflicts, you can't ignore the possibility that capital wars, in other words, maybe there's not the same inclination to buy U.S. debt and so on. We at least need to talk about those possibilities and find out who is buying and selling what that is behind these market movements.
And what?
Oof.
Yeah.
Yeah. And we know that the U.S. Treasury has been playing this game for a very long time, forcing people onto the petrodollar, sanctioning countries with financial consequences for going away from trading with the United States in dollars and all those sorts of things. So the degree to which that there's always been kind of a hidden element, like a hidden stick, and maybe that's going away, that might be the moment we're looking at. And then the question is like, what replaces it, right? What is the new system?
Yeah.
So we have Ursula von der Leyen is a German politician and president of the European Commission, the EU's executive branch, on the lessons of Bretton Woods.
1971 was the year of the so-called Nixon shock. And the decision to de-link the US dollar from gold. In an instant, the foundations of the Bretton Woods system and the entire global economic order set up after the war effectively collapsed. But it also had two major effects. It inadvertently created the conditions for what would become a truly global order. And it provided a sharp lesson for Europe and on the need to strengthen its economic and political power. It was a warning to reduce our dependencies, in this case, on a foreign currency. The world may be very different today, without any question, but I believe the lesson is very much the same. That geopolitical shocks can and must serve as an opportunity for Europe. And in my view, the seismic change we are going through today is an opportunity, in fact, a necessity to build a new form of Europe.
Yeah, so a lot of platitudes in there, but
right.
The fact that these things are being said at Davos reads to me like a Ron Paul newsletter from 2011. Right?
You mean the ones where he was a racist?
No. That was the early 2000s.
Oh, okay.
he didn't write those, Reason Magazine. Someone else did and printed under his name.
Yeah.
All right. So,
sorry.
Hey, we're just joking. We're just joshing over here.
Joshing.
Okay. So, Bretton Woods was the agreement kind of post World War II to 1971, where we had a system where it was like the U.S. is going to be like this bank of the world changing money into gold, and right. we're going to use Fort Knox to redeem these things. Around 1971, of course, you have the so-called Nixon shock that happens when he decides, I'm just not going to do that anymore.
Yeah. Right? You're good. You don't actually need that gold.
Yeah, yeah.
We're good for it.
And so since then, we've been on this floating system of the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, and the U.S. dollar, and buying dollars and treasuries, right? So this gold link being severed, I mean, pretty much it happened because of Europe, right? Like, was it France? I can't remember, France or something like that. It was hey, we'd like to turn in some of our dollars. And we're like, nah.
Nah, you're
no,
good.
Thanks.
No.
And I think we did transfer some, something like that.
Maybe.
I remember something about that. But anyways, it was not working, right? Functionally. Right. And additionally, that as soon as you get into a scary situation, the U.S. now has to export all of its gold. That's a real problem, right? So,
sort of a similar situation, what we're experiencing right now with the gold and silver vaults being drained substantially around the world, in Europe, in the United States, in China. Similar problem, right? Like they may not have had all the gold at that time for France to redeem. And so they kind of had to default on that agreement.
Yeah, right. So the question at that point, you know, is if we're at the point where all these world leaders are getting around, be like, I don't know, are we getting another 1971 moment? Are we going to have to de-dollarize? Now, that, well, it could be a lot of like scariness or like, no, sorry, political gainsmanship against the U.S. given the trade threat, Greenland, yada, yada, yada. Some other things happen in parallel here that are interesting, especially when we look at like Trump claiming he now has the framework of a Greenland deal when there's no like the other guy didn't say that happened. Is that along with this that the EU is currently trying to pass through its process the new trade deal that Trump cut with it. And that was actually voted to stall during Davos while Trump was there. Right. So that's interesting. And then there was a bunch of and then Bessent was forged a whole bunch of questions from different people saying, hey, well, this country has said that they're going to drop treasury bonds. This country said they're going to drop treasury bonds. And there was a couple other kind of threats along that. So if that's what's actually happening, they're saying like, hey, we're going to just give up on the international monetary system. Right. We're going to go some other direction. That's incredibly scary for the United States to a degree. I don't know what the ratios are. Scott and Bessent, and when he was asked, he was like, I don't give a shit what they do. Like, he was totally gangster about it.
Yeah.
But it then just begs the questions, what happens next? So we have the French central banker, François Villeray de Gallo, frames the privatization of money as a threat to national sovereignty. So we're not, the Europeans are not going to lean into Bitcoin, kids.
As I am a central banker, let me insist a bit. On at least, I gave a speech 2 weeks ago with a triangle of threats and a triangle of answer, but let me sum up. The first threat is privatization of money and loss of sovereignty for many jurisdictions. And we know this is a real fear, especially in emerging countries. But if we have only a currency in the future, which is private, and let this be honest, which is issued by American issuers, private companies, then we will have a question on sovereignty. Here's the answer, is CBDC. As I am a central bank.
Central bank digital currency is the answer.
And that was a big theme. That was a big theme in Davos this week was, I mean, that right there, Larry Fink also saying that blockchain is going to be the foundation of banking going forward. Traditional banking moving more towards that than the crypto and blockchain world coming towards traditional finance. What are the implications of that?
Yeah, not good. Well, at least in terms of, you know, he's like, privatization would be terrible. You know,
right.
It says, it's like cows saying, it's like a cow saying, hamburgers are bad for you. You know? Right. Like, it's like, this is...
Eat more chicken.
Yeah, right. This is exactly what you would expect out of a central banker, right? Where he gets to now control how much money's in the system rather than, depending on what you're talking about, right? Are you talking about Fedcoin? Would Fedcoin be dangerous for your French central banker? Maybe. Would it be dangerous for the world? Maybe. Is Bitcoin dangerous for the world? Don't see it as much. At least in terms of that, it does follow a certain set of economic rules that are, in general, pretty helpful, right? Not being controlled by an interest, such as the Rothschilds, Mr. French banker, or the Federal Reserve, 12 centralized federal banks, and the private ownership of those banks are also, you know, highly problematic and subject to political pressure that says, well, we should have low interest rates because we want a hotter economy, because that would be fun, wouldn't it?
Right.
Pouring alcohol into the punch bowl, causing the boom bust cycle, that sort of, those sort of perverse incentives. Those don't apply to Bitcoin because it's an algorithm. It can't be lobbied, right? It might be able to be hacked or something like that.
There's the developer group and, you know, whatever. I'm not going to get into that, but you're right. Yeah, it's different, fundamentally it's different.
More resistant maybe It's more resistant than a series of central bankers who are elected or who are appointed or who are just subject to the societal implications of, you know, the system they're in. Right. So that like operates on its own, has some certain benefits, can be traded easily, is fungible, moves around with relatively low transit fees. Small blockers. These are all, you know, questions that would make it more competitive than the dollar or other alternatives.
The other thing that it does that is perfectly within the scope of thought of Davos of old is provide a lot of transparency into transactions. Mm-hmm. A lot of people, I think, mistakenly think that Bitcoin specifically and a lot of different cryptocurrencies are anonymous, but they're not. They're pseudonymous, but it's very easy to tell what is going from where to where because it's all on a public blockchain. It's on a public ledger. There are companies like Chainalysis and Glassnode that can very clearly trace where payments go to and from, and they can kind of start to piece the puzzle together and figure out who is who. It's not private. And that is exactly what these guys want. Mm-hmm. They want control, right? At the end of the day, they're meeting to talk about how can we control the direction of the future? Well, the best way to do that is control where money goes to and from, to know where money goes to and from, who's spending money on what. They want to just have their fingers in every aspect of your life. And a CBDC of any kind would absolutely do that.
Yeah.
And allow them to shut it off and chain it to a social credit score, where if you eat too many cheeseburgers, you can't buy another cheeseburger because you've passed your allotment of 35 grams of animal protein per week or whatever the fuck, you know? Yeah. So to me, I despise this idea.
Yeah. So that's the extra danger of a central bank digital currency, because it could do that. At least off of other kind of blockchains, you can pivot into more secure or more private blockchains.
Mm-hmm.
You can trade cash for a blockchain address that isn't tied to anything else. You have opportunities to do more of that with a more decentralized system than a centralized system. Right. Ultimately, the danger of CBDCs are that, you know, it's combined with political power. And that's where a lot of like the conservative reaction is like, well, all blockchains bad because central bank digital currencies, and they're not really dealing with the nuance of the issue.
That's fair.
Yeah.
But certainly these bankers, these billionaires and politicians and bureaucrats are thinking in terms of that, the yep. CBDC.
And the European Central Bank leader, I won't play the video, but the European Central Bank leader that we heard it also said that the digital euro is coming soon. Right. So we're talking about next year or two, we're going to be seeing that.
I could see that. Having been in Europe recently, they are, you guys are kind of fucked. I mean, we're all kind of fucked. I'm not trying to stand on my high horse over here in America and say that we're doing better. We all have our problems, but that would be devastating to Europe.
Yeah. It's very scary, right? I mean, if you're a European citizen, I mean, I don't know, their levels of trust are different than ours, right? You know, they're kind of like, the government's us. You know, they kind of still believe that stuff.
Well, so do we, though, to a degree.
Yeah, some
Americans
do.
We the people, blah, blah, blah.
But I think we have like a, at least in the West, we have more of like a, that's a DC thing.
Yeah.
And I don't, nah. You know, like maybe my local government I'm pretty cool with.
Well, we also have the means to throw off the chains of an oppressive, abusive government mm-hmm. by way of self-defense.
Yes.
Europe does not largely have that capability.
Right. So they're much more captive audiences. Yes. They really have to play ball.
It's much harder to resist a digital euro than a digital dollar.
100%.
Yeah.
So, and as far as like what you're saying about cheeseburgers, we getting to it, returning back to eating the bugs.
Actually, now it's eating the lab-grown meat.
We're going to be eating something.
So a lot of what we're starting to see,
if you're lucky,
are these replacements for these core foods. I've tasted a bunch of, you know, future of coffee, fake coffee. How do you see that application? Because obviously we can use technology in lots of different ways, but from a values perspective, from like a the chef side of me feels like fake. I don't want a future where, even though it's a, you know, really smart, interesting technology, where we're starting to drink coffee from a factory as opposed to from a tree.
So I think that I acknowledge, let me say, there is a terrible cultural resistance from consumer to accept tech foods. But in my opinion, they represent the way forward. If you look at it from the ecological perspective, maybe we have to be selective, because we know from statistics, correct me if I'm wrong, that 70% of the ecological footprint of agriculture is due to animal proteins. And then on the other side, the kind of physiological, we know that an excessive consumption of animal proteins is the first cause of non-communicable diseases, which are the number one health problem in the Western society. So what about reducing the animal protein to the level which is healthy, and increasing, also optimizing the environmental impact? Why should I, use animals when I can cultivate meat and get only the best part of this. This, I know, it's a kind of a cultural revolution. It will take decades.
Don't you love it, Joe? Eat your lab-grown meat.
So much hubris in that statement. And I would think it would be very interesting to hear perspectives on the two points, the two facts or statistics that he quotes there, that 70% of the environmental impact globally is from animal agriculture, and that eating too much animal protein is the highest contributor to chronic disease. I would be very curious to hear from friends like Rob Wolf, for example.
Yeah.
Is that actually factually true? And also, What is a healthy amount of animal protein, as he states? Really, all this is to me is him thinking someone should tell you how much is healthy.
Mm-hmm.
Because we know better than you how to run your own life.
I'm very skeptical of the whole animal protein is the number one cause of non-communicable disease.
Where does that come from?
I don't know, man. Like, I've just seen too much. I've just seen too many people stop eating carbs and not be fat anymore.
Yeah.
To think that's true.
How do you address premium, like nutrient density in animal protein versus plant protein?
Yeah.
Bioavailability and absorption. I mean, like, these things are I mean, there, of course, food is difficult to study, right?
Sure.
It's because it's epidemiological and it's really tough to control someone's diet and create a proper study. I don't know the first thing about it other than enough to be dangerous, but that seems like a really, really big leap to make. And I would love to see the internet tear this apart.
Yeah. I mean, it's just not that. That's why it's such a great political lever, is because you can study it and just do your regression analysis and get whatever you want out of it
every single goddamn time. Easy to lie with statistics.
Because it's complicated. When things are simple, if you have a simple, if you can articulate it at an Occam's razor type of thing, right, where it's like the simple formulation, the same way E equals MC squared is very complicated conceptually, but is a very straightforward explanation of the relationship between mass and energy. So too, when we think about metabolic health, we're saying, well, wait a minute, maybe if you're suddenly all the time pumped with insulin, that's a bad thing, right? And that could be bad for parts of your health. Therefore, maybe a lower insulin, you know, intensive diet that would be more leaning into fats and protein might be healthier for you. People have been experimenting with that and getting great results. And then you come along and say, nah, we know otherwise. It's like, no, wait a we don't know otherwise.
No. And the other part of this whole conversation that really concerns me is the amount of control that it puts on the food system.
Yeah.
Right? It's very, as soon as your animal protein, quote unquote, your meat is coming from a lab and coming from a factory, you are at the control of what they want to put in it.
Mm-hmm.
Right? They're 3D printing it or growing it or whatever they're doing, and they can put any sort of genetic material in there that they want. And they're already trying to, you know, inject livestock with mRNA vaccines, and they have, you know, these self-replicating mRNA vaccines and other things that they're starting to put into the food.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if all of a sudden, let's say they make it illegal to own your own herd of cattle so that you can get your own beef.
Yeah.
And all you can get is lab grown meat, you have no control over what's in that.
Yeah. So why I like lab grown meat is in the idea that it could be very difficult to transport a cow to Mars. So like, let's use lab grown meat on Mars.
Great. But you know, don't require me
exactly
to eat it.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm not, to be fair, this guy doesn't actually propose that any policy or any forcing or any of that. He's just saying like this technology is valuable for these reasons to steel man his perspective.
Sure. Yep.
And there are, I think, at least in America, much more like just opposition to lab-grown meat just on its face. And mostly because
it's gross.
Politically because of the agricultural lobby.
Well, sure.
Right, right. And it's like ranchers and people in the agricultural groups giving to ban lab-grown meat or make sure it's labeled that way.
But it's unnatural. It's completely unnatural.
Sure.
In a time and in a country where the trend is in the exact opposite direction, I think he's exactly right. There is a tremendous cultural opposition to this idea, and it's going to be more than decades if I have anything to say about it.
Just let me be the edgy one here real quick. So to me, that's all valid, right? I totally understand where those norms come from, but it is a natural fallacy, right? Being natural doesn't necessarily make it good.
Sure,
right?
Of course.
So like, therefore, you know, should people have the freedom to experiment with lab-grown meat and like figure out how to do it as long as it doesn't lie to anybody, deceive anybody, or force anybody? I'm very comfortable with it.
Sure.
But when I see this guy say it with that accent, I'm like, this motherfucker's trying to force it on me. I know it.
You can see the Klaus Schwab suit appear on his body. And you're like, you are an evil villain, aren't you?
You know, it's something about European accents. And I know Europeans are great people. But whenever you have that one, it's the German kind of thing. I've always just like, oh, it's Hollywood's indoctrinated me with like the Dr. Evil thing. Where yeah. I'm just like, it's a guy can't be trusted.
Yeah.
I don't know about
that. I agree.
All right, so let's land on a high note. We're going to talk about robots. We've got so many robots. Elon, oh, I just turned off my trackpad.
I didn't know you could do that.
Yeah, on my noting here. Yeah, there we go. All right. Yeah, so Elon came in. He was interviewed by Fink from BlackRock, which was interesting.
Larry Fink.
Mr. Fink.
Who is now like the chairman of the WEF. Yeah. He's taken Klaus Schwab's place since Klaus Schwab resigned to, you know, spend some more time at his lair.
in a volcano.
In a volcano.
And actually, my prediction is in the benign scenario of the future that the robots will actually make so many robots in AI that they will actually saturate all human needs. Meaning you won't be able to even think of something to ask the robot for at a certain point. Like there will be such an abundance of goods and services. Because my prediction is there'll be more robots than people. So,
but how do you then have human purpose in that scenario?
Yeah, I mean, you know, there was nothing's perfect, you know. it is a necessary. Like you can't have both. You can't have work that has to be done, and amazing abundance for all.
So
that's such a can of worms.
More robots than people. Yeah,
that's such a can of worms.
No. Why is it a can of worms?
Well, I mean,
it's really straightforward.
I think it's a fair question.
Sounds awesome.
Well, I mean, it does. To not have to do work, but also, what does that do to just like the basic fundamentals of human purpose and drive? And like, what do you do with your time? How do you make money? How do you survive? How do you feed yourself? Is this UBI? Are the robots going to bring us UBI?
Won't Fink get all the pleasure of being able to tell a human what to do? You know? I mean, it's not fun telling a robot what to do, but if you tell a human what to do, they get that sense of power and dominance. You're like, oh, I own you, boy, you know? But a robot, you don't feel bad about it. Or you don't feel good about it. You're just like, oh, that's, you exist to do that.
But you better be nice in case they ever uprise.
We all get to be Fink. In case they uprise. Oh, come on. That's a silliness.
I don't think so.
I don't get me wrong. I think there's a theoretical danger, but a real danger. You have to believe things that are kind of absurd, in my opinion, about these things.
I don't know.
We got to believe that companies would have like an incentive to, that companies would be more interested in providing autonomy at the sacrifice of service, right? You have to think like, oh, we're going to make them so autonomous, they're just like a person. And like, nobody wants that. What people want, what consumers want, so they can sell them to you so that you can have access to them, so that you can actually get to this hyper productivity, is to solve consumer needs. And nobody has a need for a fully autonomous, like they have a need for a robot that's sufficiently autonomous, but not one that is resentful or, you know, those sorts of things. Does that make sense?
Yes, to whatever degree that can be prevented through code. And I don't know if our ultimate end here is AGI, artificial general intelligence, and some degree of perceived sentience, whatever that explicitly means in a robot, mm-hmm. can that be resisted ultimately is I think the question, because I mean, sitting where we're sitting right now, if you had told me that we would have what AI is right now 10, 20 years ago, mm-hmm. I couldn't even conceptualize interacting with a computer in the way that I do right now.
You could vibe code.
10 to 20 years from now, I can't conceptualize what AI infused robots will be like, or what they can do, mm-hmm. or how they will behave. And what their, you know, the horizon of their capability could be.
Right. I don't think anyone knows. Like even Elon in this interview is like, I don't know what's going to happen. But I can tell you in the short run.
Sure.
In the short run, it looks like an enormous increase of amount of humanoid shaped robots that can service human needs.
Sure.
It seems very clearly a ginormous win. The James Cameron or iRobot type outcome, I'm skeptical of, if anything, because to me, the way that these orientate are usually towards solving particular problems with intelligence, not necessarily with sentience And I don't, there's a difference between sentience and intelligence, right? You can be very smart, very able to navigate the world and fold laundry or do the dishes or drive your car or do the things that we want you to do. That is not really that helpful to be much more than that, right? And so there's probably a diminishing return at some point, and I assume that we will get somewhere close to the diminishing return, and then it'll be so expensive or whatever that we're just no longer as interested in, or we only use it when we're going to space or something much more complicated.
Sure.
Or you'll go on and be like, hey, you know, I'm a material science researcher, so I'm using a intelligence that's much smarter than me every day to try to operationalize its intelligence into new discoveries so that I can then instruct robots to go do that in the real world. And I do that not necessarily because I need to do it, but because I want to do it. Right? Does that make sense? That's
sure.
That's the vision for universal high income that I could see that actually kind of relies on something that looks like economic laws rather than like a techno-communism or something like that that doesn't make a lot of sense.
I think that's a very positive outlook, but I also think it's kind of a utopian outlook because I don't think that all humans are going to treat this situation the same. Right. Let's look at welfare as an example, because this is sort of a form of welfare. Right. If you had a robot to do all your house chores and you didn't have to do anything, any of them for yourself, what would you spend your time doing? Mm-hmm. A driven individual with like some sort of intrinsic motivation to be creative or explore or build things would go do those things. Not everyone has that. Mm-hmm. Some people would probably devolve into malaise and maybe drug and alcohol abuse and become a shadow of themselves as a result of the fact of not actually having responsibilities to keep them on track.
Yeah.
Right?
Sure. But those people exist in our society today, right? If you go to your
average, I think it's just going to exacerbate that.
If you go to your average trailer park in Montana right now and you go around and like get to know some of those folks, you're going to find people who literally work just so they can go hunting.
Yeah.
Right. So what are they going to do if they have a robot? Is they're going to go to work and then they're going to use the robot to take out all the chores at home and then they're going to go hunting. Right.
But what happens when their work gets replaced by a robot?
Well, they'll be managing robots. Like, it's hard to imagine. So,
but again, let's say it takes one person to manage 10 robots or 100 robots.
Then the price of those goods and services go down, and you won't have to work nearly as much to get the same amount of goods and services.
But we have the number of people we have currently, but if only 10% of them are required to manage a fleet of robots, then what happens to the other 90% who no longer have jobs?
What they would have jobs, right?
So
one of the things that's the error that Fink makes here is he assumes that there is an end to human desire, right? Human satisfactor of needs, and that's not true, right? The basics of economics shows that scarcity is finite, human needs are infinite. Right. So we will find new things for people to do to satisfy needs as we go, even as we get, say, for example, how many billions of people are on the planet? 8 billion?
I think coming up on eight. Yeah.
Yeah. Coming up on eight.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, that's right. So even if there was another 8 billion robots, humanoid robots that could service people, you would then have a desire for the comparative advantage that humans provide that robots don't, knowing that they're robots. Right. Now, over a 100-year period where robots start to look exactly, and you get like the Blade Runner type scenario where you can't tell the difference, then it might get a little bit weirder too. But you're still looking at the core question of like, is there a comparative advantage between humans and robots? And yeah, there will continue to be. And you will get paid based upon the things that you do and provide for other people's services. I struggle to see how, I see Elon's vision of like, that causes massive depression of prices for goods and services, meaning that everyone can get access to things much cheaper. Yeah, otherwise would.
Right.
That also means they would also put pressure on wages, but also distribute wages wider because you have a depression on wages, you distribute it wider, right? Therefore, more quantity of total wage growth.
Sure.
So in your ability to purchase power with those wages. When you do that, then you have people who are much poorer. If you're currently doing landscaping, you would do landscaping and you have like 3 or 4 guys, mostly teenagers, who would do it with you. Now teenagers are going to stay and not do as much landscaping, and they'd probably manage robots themselves doing other things, right? And you would manage, as an older person, a series of robots who would then go out and do that. And you would deal with the customer and you would be managing, maintaining the robots, and they would be doing it themselves. And you would be in that position of control, probably, because that's where most people would gain the most trust in the marketplace and provision of robot services.
Okay.
Would be my
Interesting.
Guess.
Interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. At least over the short enough time frame, we're not getting like super sci-fi, right? We're like, okay, you know, robots with telepathy and shit, like, you know, like a robot controlling with your neural link the robot and how it does that, or like projection and sort of things that you could do when you get really weird, which is a thing that Elon talked about in another interview recently. But yeah,
it's interesting because I know this. You meant this is a white pill, and I think that's fine, and I'm not going to rain on it. I have a slightly different view.
Okay, all right. Hit me with your black pill.
Well,
and then we'll finish out with him being an alien.
Yeah. Well, I see the general predisposition and the overt messaging from the global elite that we see gathered in Davos this week. Mm-hmm. That is generally negative towards the population of humans that currently exist on the planet. And their wish is that there were fewer of us because we're a negative, we are a negative, the word is escaping me, but we're impact on the planet, yes. on the climate, right? Yeah. To me, the growth in robotics and the lack of need of humans is sort of the next step towards reducing population because we need people less. That we're just going to become the useless eaters, right? Mm-hmm. The cattle that no longer serve a purpose because now we're growing meat in a lab to, you know, twist those metaphors around to take together. Sure. So I see this as sort of trending in a bad direction for human flourishing generally, probably for the least skilled, lowest income, you know, least intelligent people in the planet, right? Those people are going to become more or less obsolete. And then there will be sort of this power law distribution of a few people who have the drive and intelligence to use this, to ride this wave to a vastly higher degree of wealth and control yeah. and concentration of power.
But I think the actual evidence that we've seen with AI so far is that actually the people who suffer the most are the most mediocre, non-skilled, non-laborer people. Right. When people talk about low skilled, what they're often talking about people who haven't graduated high school, who have like a services job or have a trade job. And I actually disagree. I think those are the last people to be automated by robots. And that
the guy that flips burgers at McDonald's who's already being replaced by a robot?
No, you're a guy who digs the foundations for your houses and roofs your houses and does all that work. I think those are actually the hardest things to replace with robots.
So, but that's, yeah. I mean, I guess maybe not concrete. But, you know, like electricians, plumbers, those are kind of skilled labor jobs.
Trade labor. Yeah, that's what I meant by trade labor. But okay. Yeah, I'm still talking, if you're talking about landscaping, once again, that's why I used landscaping earlier. It's like that is, it is easy to get into, hard to master, right? Like actual landscaping is not as easy as it looks, right? But there's a ton of physical labor that does break bodies over time that will benefit tremendously as you have your individual landscaper who runs a crew right now, mostly of ex-cons and young people. I know this because I've worked landscaping for 15 years. Don't talk to me.
Don't at me, bro.
Yeah. That they will then probably employ more robot labor and there'll be more total labor resources for landscaping, right?
Sure.
And so things that wouldn't get landscaped will suddenly get landscaped.
So we're going to see a renaissance of beautification because robots exist. More people will get their yards landscaped. There'll be less detritus in your neighborhood.
Yes.
It'll look more beautiful because of robots.
100%.
Okay. All right. I'll take that one.
That's the upside. Now, the other side of it, like you said, like those people are going to get left behind is I'm like, well, I think that is more similar to their vision of humanity than what I see. Because my vision, don't get me wrong, I think the threat's real. I think there are environmentalists who legitimately think that. And that's a hugely problematic problem, 100%.
Yeah.
Yeah, on board. That said, I think they're wrong about the economics and that they're fighting the tide of economics and that position loses because the economics tell us that the curve for human desire is infinite and resources are finite, that therefore we will continue to commonize on resources to solve human needs and we'll do it with more robots and it'll become cheaper, more abundant, and more, especially the poorest people will benefit the most.
Cool. I hope that's
because
right.
Because imagine if you've ever been poor, having a robot that cleans your house. And what a difference that would make in your life.
Oh, huge.
Yeah. And then tell me that that's a bad thing for people. Like, I'm still like, I'm not, other than the James Cameron scenario, how is that a bad thing? Right? Or the Matrix scenario, something like that. All right. Yeah. All right. Elon is an alien. Go.
From the future.
I'm often asked, are there aliens among us? And I'll say that I am one. But
or you're from the future.
They don't believe me.
Okay.
So I think if anyone would know if there are aliens among us, it would be me. We have 9,000 satellites up there, and not once have we had to maneuver around an alien spaceship. So I'm like, I don't know. Bottom line is, I think we need to assume that life and consciousness is extremely rare, and it might only be us. And if that's the case, then we need to do everything possible to ensure that the light of consciousness is not extinguished. I'm often asked.
Yeah. And what he's talking about there is going to Mars, right? That the likelihood of a disaster on our planet wiping out consciousness is far lessened if we are on a second planet.
Sure.
So therefore, moon base and therefore Mars base. And you really need to do that well. Do that the safest way for people is autonomous robots, right? Because then you can send the robots who then are pre-programmed. You can train them on the planet to do a certain thing, to set up the base, to set up all the systems for people. And then you don't need to remote control them because you have this enormous 9-minute lag to control a robot from Earth to Mars because of the speed of light. Therefore, you can send them there and they can actually build that stuff autonomously on their own. Right.
Cool.
Right. Yeah, that's a really great thing.
I love it.
But sounds also fun. Him being an alien is kind of weird. That's always that's a weird
thing. He says I am one. Yeah, what do you think he means by that?
Yeah, he's definitely a Draco. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
A Draco. Yeah, they're the shape changers, right?
Yeah.
I don't
really know either.
Me and my buddy did a deep dive on this. We watched some weird documentaries, man. Got weird. And my understanding is that there's like 5 different kinds, and one of them is the Dracos, and they can actually look like us, and they transform and shit.
That's whoa. Yeah. Are they the good ones?
No.
Uh-oh.
They live in Antarctica, which is weird, but they say there are underground vents in Antarctica that keep it warm inside.
Oh.
The ice, like an igloo.
No kidding.
Yeah.
Hollow Earth theory?
What was it called? It's called, what was the documentary we watched? I think it was called Beyond Majestic. It was, it's on Amazon. It was wild, dude. Like
I will be watching this.
No, don't. It's not worth your time. It's so bad. It's so bad. Yeah. It's not, there are great alien documentaries like, there's all kinds of great UFO and alien documentaries out there that are really trying to prove a case.
Yeah.
This one doesn't even try. It's just like, this guy's like, yeah. And then I went to high school and I went into a special program and then I went to Jupiter. And you're like, what?
Okay.
I've been to Jupiter. I've seen
even. Isn't that all gas?
There's a theory that the Nazis perfected space travel through anti-gravity and then sent submarines, Nazi submarines into space. It's a long story, but you got to check it out.
Whoa.
Yeah.
I want whatever they're smoking.
Yeah, and something else. But maybe that's what Elon is. He's a Draco.
That's true. We did skip over one major story, and I want to talk about it. I know we're going a little bit long, but I think this is worth it. Okay.
I got my 3 o'clock.
Okay, yeah. Really quick. James O'Keefe infiltrates Davos and gets them to admit that geoengineering is real. Mm-hmm. And I put on my free space on my bingo card. I'll have you guys remember that would come to light. And that the practice would be stopped.
Mm.
And it is coming to light. People are talking about it. It's been admitted at the highest levels that the military has been doing it for a long time. We've known this, but hopefully this is the momentum we need to continue to push into the limelight.
Yeah, maybe we cover that next week because we didn't get to it today.
Yes, we can do that. All right. David, thank you so much. Everybody at home, thank you so much for watching and listening. This has been another episode of Human Reaction. We appreciate you very much for being here. Like, subscribe, hit the notification bell, and join us in the Discord. The link is below. We'll see you next time.
Peace.
Thanks for tuning in to Human Reaction. Please be sure to like, follow, subscribe, and give us a review on your podcast platform of choice. And if you want to become a member and support the show financially, check out humanreactionpod.com.